This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik filling in for Dan Hurley. During the 1968-69 school year, a time of protests and racial violence, an all-black high school in Columbus, Ohio, won the state's basketball and baseball championships. In his latest book, Tigerland, 1968-1969, A City Divided, A Nation Torn Apart, and A Magical Season of Healing, journalist Will Haygood tells the story of Columbus's East High School and how its athletes and coaches persevered during a time of heightened racial tension to win two state championships. Will Haygood recently spoke with Dan Hurley about Tigerland and what lessons we can learn from it about race relations in America.
Well, Will Haygood, it's wonderful to have you here today, and very nice to know that you're coming back to Miami University.
Yeah, thank you very much, and I'm really looking forward to it. A lot of fond memories, and I think it's a book that certainly will resonate for the freshman class. It's just a wonderful time to be coming back.
Well, how did you happen upon this story of Columbus East High School? Were you searching for a local story that would allow you to explore some national forces that were really tearing at the nation 1968-69, or did you just hear about this and say, wait a minute, this is a powerful story in its own right, and go from there? How did the origins of this come about?
Several things. Super question, by the way. I was born in Columbus, Ohio. I left there to go to college, and then I worked for various big newspapers like the Boston Globe and the Washington Post. And I had an opportunity to travel all around the country and the world and find these fascinating stories. And so one week, I would guess about 10 years ago, I'm back in my hometown of Columbus, Ohio, and I run into one of the championship basketball players from East High School, and he just got to talking about the year 1968-69, and then he said, but Will, the school won two championships that year, two state championships. And I said, two? What was the other one? And he said, it was baseball. And I said, whoa, wait a minute. East won the baseball championship the same year that they won the basketball championship. And he said, yes, Will, and no one ever talks about that. I mean, that was the sort of lost championship from that year. No one went to the games. No one talked about it. And so while I was in town on that visit 10 years ago, I went straight to the library and looked it up. And lo and behold, there it was, East High, in the late spring of 69, 55 days after winning the basketball championship, won the state baseball championship. And it locked in my mind right then and there. Someday, some way, I've got to write a book about this, and that's how it started.
Okay. Well, you know, the basketball championship, although, you know, nothing like that is ever certain, Columbus East was a well-established basketball power. But
yes.
Baseball, as you say, nobody was paying attention, partly because high school baseball, not a lot of people attend anyway, but they were not a power. Traditionally in baseball. So it was really this quirk and this overlap that took place here. It's amazing.
Yes, it was. They lost five games in that baseball season. They lost five straight games. And so for them to rebound and to recharge themselves going into the state tournament was really quite amazing. And I think that the huge story here is that this nation was undergoing such racial and political turmoil in the calendar year 1968-69 that it is a miracle that they could hold themselves together. None of the players got in trouble. They all stayed eligible. which is an amazing story of grit and resilience. I mean, it still was a segregated school. They didn't get adequate funding. Schools they played against were either all white or mixed schools, but they got more money. And so there were all sorts of obstacles and that these players had to endure. And to keep winning in that milieu, to me, is quite a story.
Well, you write at one point that these players, when they played as if their lives depended on it, because often it did. Talk about the role of sports for the students and for the community that lived around Columbus East.
Mm-hmm. Well, this too, really, literally, was the very first generation of blacks who had been freed by the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Civil Rights Bill and the 1968 Housing Bill. And those were three bills that affected every single black person in this nation. And on the East Side community, you had your lowest income populace live there. And so it was this burst of freedom. I would say about 95% of these players came from families where no one had ever went to college. And it was expensive to go to college. And so if you had a skill, an athletic skill, and if you could get a full scholarship, then that meant that you, that senior high school student, had opened a whole new world for your family just by virtue of going off to college, of opening a door, of shining a light on the higher education, and to sending a message to your younger siblings that, hey, this can be achieved. Somebody in this family now has stepped up onto that ladder, and I want others in the family to step up onto that ladder. That, to me, is just a heartbreakingly beautiful story.
Well, you know, you talk in great depth about a lot of people who were involved in that year at Columbus East, but there's a couple students who really jump out. One is Eddie Ratliff, the Rat.
Yep.
Bo Peep, Lamar, yeah. Garnett Davis, yep. Just to name three of them.
Yep.
Do you think that those, and particularly Eddie Ratliff, do you think he was just so, I mean, incredibly talented, both in baseball and basketball, but do you think he was just so focused on his, on athletics? That was his way he could express himself? Or was it that they were driven because he somehow understood that this was the ticket out?
Yes, I think he was extraordinarily driven, but he was also extremely mature. Many players have told me that he seemed to be like a man among students. He was very mature. He played basketball, and they would win sometimes by whopping margins. And the first thing he would do is he would go over to the losing players, and he would talk to them very quietly, and he would tell them that it was okay, that winning's not everything, that you guys have a good team, and that you ought to stick with it, and you ought to keep working hard. He sounded almost like a coach. and so he was one of those figures who comes along once every maybe 30 years. He's just super gifted, super smart, very humble. And, you know, there were some things also going on in his home. He did not get along well with his stepfather, who was a very mean man, He drank too much. And so I think it found a reason to stay out of the home a lot. And so sports was his salvation.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things about the families that these students came from that you explore is, and I'm a historian by background.
Okay.
But I think you do a better job at explaining the human impact of the migration of African Americans who had been living in the South as sharecroppers, and sort of what their situation was in that first generation coming north in terms of what it did to their families and how this interacted and people doing things so that their children had a chance. I mean, talk a little bit about the impact of that migration from the South to the North.
Yes, you are so right. I mean, you know, it's hard enough within a city when a child, say, in the fourth or fifth or eighth grade, is told by their mom and dad that we will be moving next year to another side of town. So the kid is going to lose his friends, he's going to lose his teachers, et cetera. But when you move from state to state, I mean, you're going into a totally different environment. And these mothers and fathers who left the South, there was a big reason. Emmett Till, the 15-year-old black kid who was murdered in Mississippi for whistling at a white woman, that happened in 1955. And so all of these players who later wound up on these championship teams at East, ones who were born in the South, and many were, they were like 5 and 6 years old then. So their mothers and fathers knew well the Emmett Till story. And so that was just one more reason to flee the South. And so during that period, that big wave of blacks hopping on trains, hopping on buses, finding rides to go into these northern cities like Dayton, like Cincinnati, like Cleveland, like Columbus, like in Detroit, Michigan, New York City, all that happened, you know, for years and years. And it, you know, it was sort of the luck of the draw where your family might land. My grandparents were raised and born in Selma, Alabama, and so was my mother. But in 1942, they all came north, straight to Columbus, Ohio. I mean, and so
did they know somebody in Columbus? Was that why Columbus?
My grandfather had two brothers who had fled the South, and that's where both of them hopped off the train.
There you go.
And settled. Yeah. It isn't, I mean, it's just luck or just a risk of where your family might have landed. I mean, I had an aunt from Georgia, my father's sister. They landed in Cincinnati, and they still live there.
So, you know, we're talking about some of the students, but adults play a real role in your story, too. And there's a couple of them. Jack Gibbs, who was the first African-American high school principal in Columbus, becomes principal at East. He's an incredible character who really plays a very important role in this critical year. But then there's Bob Hart, the basketball coach, and Paul Pinnell, the baseball coach, who are white. So talk about those, that threesome.
Yes, I can tell how closely you have read this book, and I thank you for that. But Bob Hart, World War II veteran, he was in World War II, he was overseas, he saw how the U.S. military treated blacks. And when he got back to his college, which was Ohio Wesleyan, he had to find a subject matter for his senior thesis. His senior thesis was about the mistreatment of the black soldier during World War II. Now that is sort of radical idea for a white young man from the Midwest to choose that topic as the subject. But got an A, and he had a social conscience, and he coached at some small high schools around the state. And when he got an opportunity to become the reserve coach at East High School, many of his friends told him not to take that job because it was in a very poor area of town. But they did not know that this was the same Bob Hart who was standing up for black soldiers in World War II. So he happily took that job. And he got to know the families. He lived in the neighborhood. So to go from World War II and to see black soldiers fighting for their country, the same black soldiers who could come back to the USA and not be treated fairly, Bob Hart knew this nation needed to change. And if he could become a father figure to some of those basketball players, he was willing to do it. He was also very lucky in that these players, as you mentioned earlier, they were really playing as if their very lives depended on it. And Bob Hart even says that in the book. He knew that these players, if they could be successful in high school, if they could keep their grades up, if they could win, that they could get some attention.
And we should probably point out that a number of those students ended up playing in the NBA. And getting drafted into Major League Baseball, although that story didn't turn out to be so good. Anything to say about Jack Gibbs? I mean, I found him a fascinating character.
Yes, he is. He is absolutely one of the larger heroes of this book. I think it's a book with many heroes, but Jack Gibbs, Harlan, Kentucky born, very poor, hitchhiked his way to Columbus, worked at night, walked on to the Ohio State football team in the early 50s. He sat on the bench, but he had some success in certain games, one game against Michigan.
Pretty good game to choose.
He intercepted a pass, and helped the team win, and he became sort of a local folk hero and started rising up through the school ranks. Then he was the vice principal at East. He wanted the head job on two occasions, but he didn't get it. It went to white men. He was upset, but he stayed, and he finally got the principal's job, and he was a taskmaster. He really drove the students. He loved the students. He was strict, but he was also loving. Here's a great story. As you know from the book. So the team reaches the baseball tournament, and all during the season, no students ever came to their games, to their home baseball game. Sometimes it was two or three students there, and it was awful, and the players were hurt. But in their semifinal tournament baseball game on the campus of Ohio State University, where Jack Gibbs had attended, the day before, Jack Gibbs goes around to the east side of the city, and he talks to store owners and flower shop owners, and he says, look, I need to rent some buses to get a lot of East High students to the game. I don't know if the players are going to win, if they're going to lose. I don't care. But when those players get out of their cars for the semifinal game tomorrow, I want them to see hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of East High Tiger students in the stadium. Help me, please. And then he said, I think it will inspire them to really play to the best of their ability if they see their student body. And the players who I interviewed, they got out the car and they walked onto the field, looked into the bleachers, and saw hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Tiger players. They had never seen that scene during the season. And if it wasn't for Jack Gibbs, those students wouldn't have been there. And, of course, East High wins that semifinal game. And then Jack Gibbs goes back and says, hey, I need more money. I need more buses. We're in the state championship game tomorrow, and he gets more money. In the 11th hour, he gets more buses. He gets more students, and they win.
And I think it's fair to point out that money didn't, as you said, came from the local businesses. It didn't come from the school system. We're about to run out of time, but I just have to ask one more question.
Yeah.
As I was reading this book, Tigerland, President Trump attacked LeBron James and in the process really attacked sports and the role of sports. What are your thoughts on that in the midst of having written this book and in the midst of that discussion that's going on in our country right now?
Mm-hmm. I think the message from the White House was ugly and painful and hurtful. It showed that the people in the White House have no sense of the racial history of this country. Black athletes have always been at the forefront of social activism. I thank LeBron James for saying what he said and for standing up for the sanctity of unity in sports. Look at Jesse Owens. Look at Jackie Robinson. Look at Gale Sayers. Look at Muhammad Ali. Look at LeBron James. You can go on and on. It is very important in this country that we honor what the black athlete has done in the name of racial unity and social unity. And I'm going to look forward to talking about these very issues in the very near future when I'm out on the road talking about this book.
Well, thank you for being with us today, and I wish you well as you speak to the incoming class at Miami University, and good luck with this book as you promote it around the country. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Will Haygood, Miami University's Bodway Distinguished Scholar in Residence, will speak at Miami's convocation tomorrow. Each incoming student in the class of 2022 will receive a signed copy of Tigerland, which will be used to teach classes this fall. Producer for today's program was Pete Reitmeier. Our assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Today's technical director was Josh Elstrow. Segment producer is Layla Shakui. Archives of our program are available on our website, wvxu.org. I'm Marianne Zalesnik, filling in for Dan Hurley. Stay tuned for Here and Now, coming up next.